Thank you very much for that welcome. It is indeed a crucial period. Whenever is it not a crucial period on Iran? But five things to draw attention to. Iran itself, the state of its regime, its internal and external policy, you could describe as unfinished, a revolution within the revolution which began and has not yet been completed. The negotiations are teetering. The priorities for the six negotiating countries are in doubt. There is pressure for a break to the process that has scarcely begun, but which did look optimistic for a short period in the autumn, and pressure for sanctions. And in fact, I think I shall contend that the slogan of a twin-track approach has probably now outlived its usefulness. We need some patience and some additional creativity, and I shall suggest some ways in which that might be seen through. My talk will have four movements to it, like the best classical symphonies. Inside Iran and the nuclear negotiations are the big movements, the first and last ones, and we'll get to the negotiations via a short, slow movement on Iran and the region and a lively scherzo on UK-Iran relations. A lot of ex-ambassadors are like underemployed orchestral conductors. In my 30 minutes, I shall go beyond time signatures and tempos and attempt an interpretation. In other words, in plain words, and before my analogy collapses, I'll have a go at policy. So to start with what's going on inside Iran. Basically, it is the same Iran, despite the events of June. The trends that were apparent for many years, though, have been intensified. And the system is weaker because it is more disunited. Why do I say it's the same Iran? Well, one reason is, and this is an exaggeration, but it makes my point, that the decision to fix the 2009 election was actually taken in 2001. What I mean by that is that after the second victory of President Khatami that year, the powers that be were seriously scared that reformism might undermine the revolution. We started to see a serious backlash which hobbled President Khatami in that year. We saw the sentencing of Professor Arghajari, which in many ways to me was a milestone in which a noted supporter and fighter for the revolution was sentenced to death for blasphemy. And another milestone I think we can see in retrospect, which shows how what happened after June was prefigured, was a speech which Ahmadinejad gave in March 2008, when he expanded on his view that the hidden imam supported him and his policies. He argued that Iran's global mission would soon be at hand and that it was time to wrap up all the various distractions of domestic policy. That was March 2008. But 2009 was the year in which, and this is a major discontinuity, in which Khamenei took sides dramatically to support Ahmadinejad as a presidential candidate, despite the extent and nature of the challenge to the nature of his victory. And why he did that was because he wished to intensify what he calls the cultural war, the war against influences inside Iran which might ultimately demolish the revolution. I'm going to quote here from an article some of you may have seen by Maziar Bahari, a Newsweek journalist just released and who's written about his experiences. Ayatollah Khamenei, he wrote just the other day, liked to warn Iranians about a cultural NATO as threatening as the military one, a network of journalists, activists, scholars and lawyers who supposedly sought to undermine the Islamic Republic from within. Anyone on the streets of Tehran in June, Mr. Bahari went on, would have known just how spontaneous, even leaderless, the post-election protests had been. But Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guards clearly believed, or at least wanted Iranians to believe, that they had been orchestrated by foreigners. They called the plot a velvet revolution or a soft overthrow. "You are worse than any saboteur or killer," Bahari's interrogator raged on the first day of his interrogation. "Those criminals destroy an object or a person. You destroy minds and provoke people against the leader." But the fact that this attempt to control politics by reorienting society has not yet been completed leaves Iran in a very febrile mood. Not only do we see the intense factionalism and personal rivalries with which we are familiar, but we see the kind of criticism from leaders who had previously been quiet and muted in their concerns, now speaking out. Mohsin Rezai, one of the failed presidential candidates this time, said in Ertemad Melli, the newspaper, just the day before yesterday, "National unity has lost its effectiveness. We must all accept that the country's current situation is not that appropriate. We must soon find a way to get out of our existing bad condition. The country is facing social, cultural and moral crisis." But what about those protests, the Green Movement? What is its future? Well, I don't think it's very good in the short term. There's no organisation left beyond the informal communication that can take place when it is decided that demonstrations will be mounted. There's no media outlets. There is a sense of powerlessness and a sense, you know, what can we do given the nature of the crackdown? Yes, the protests were unprecedented, 3 million on the streets. Yes, popular defiance still exists, but it hasn't got an outlet that is going to seriously affect the conduct of politics in the short term. Long term, of course, the seed of further action in future to promote a genuine democracy has been sown, and that is what has changed in 2009. And the role of the women of the Green Movement must be mentioned. Their courage and their leadership, even if not in the streets, on the rooftops, that is a discontinuity, something which has been latent, where people are now standing up for what they think. Of course, the many different aims within the Green Movement influence its current situation. The leaders are loyalists. They're people who want to see the Islamic Revolution saved from itself, the Islamic Republic rescued, republicanism rescued from one particular slavish interpretation of the Islamic element within the system. But their view is not shared by the majority of the foot soldiers, the people in the street, who want to see a efficient government and a freer government and don't see how that can be delivered by the clerics. But the fact that this unresolved well of discontent exists does make the regime very uneasy. It has not finished what it started. It has not suppressed dissent, reformism or centrism. It's struggling from day to day. A lot of has been written about the role of the Revolutionary Guards. They were always there in the background. They did have to move to the foreground because of the unprecedented nature of that challenge on the streets. To quote Mazyar Bahari again, "IRGC intelligence is now responsible for Iran's internal security, which means that its paranoias have suffused the regime. There remain players within the system who can make rational decisions about Iran's international interests. If there weren't, I, Mazyar Bahari, would still be in jail. But the guards are exacerbating the Islamic Republic's worst instincts its insecurity and deep suspiciousness. As world powers try to engage Iran to mitigate the threat of its nuclear program, it's critical that they understand this mindset and the role the IRGC now plays within the Iranian system. So to sum up what's going on inside, the government remains in control, it remains capable of taking decisions, but the extent of the fissures within make it very hard to reach agreement on an actual strategy and an actual policy, and we'll get onto that in a minute. So what is their worldview now? Well, clearly the priority is domestic. And it's domestic in dealing with the day-to-day decisions that have to be taken, notably in the economic sphere on ending subsidies in order to give their budget more headroom, but without promoting a revolution from below, from the poorer in society left having to spend more. In the report which Chatham House did last year, we homed in on the fact that many in Iran realize that they cannot mend their economy without an accommodation with more of the outside world. I think we overestimated the speed at which this insight would sink in. I thought that it would have sunk in by now, in effect, but it hasn't. If it is going to sink in, that, in other words, to put it at its most basic, they won't be able to maintain a significant hydrocarbon export potential in 5 to 10 years' time unless they massively increase the rate at which they invest in their resources now and manage their resources more efficiently. And that means reintroducing Western and other oil majors into the process on terms that those majors find acceptable. That realization will sink in due course, I believe, but it's going to be too late to influence attitudes to the nuclear negotiations within the timescale required. So also within their worldview, they're struggling with the policy dilemma which has been evident now for many years. It was summed up in a meeting which I attended in 2005 with the then head of the Supreme National Security Council, Larijani, who is now the speaker of the Iranian Majlis. He said Iran's options are to surrender, to nobly defy, or to maneuver in such a way as to preserve the gains of the revolution. Now, he favored the maneuver option. Nobody in Iran, right the way through to the greenest, is talking about surrendering to the kinds of pressures which are mounted from Europe and the United States. Which they're going to choose between noble defiance, which is what you associate with the most extreme of the statements you read of Iranian policy, and a resumption of the kind of manoeuvring which we saw from June onwards when Ahmadinejad wrote to the IAEA saying, please help us get fuel for our research reactor. Which we're going to see dominant in future, we simply cannot forecast. At the moment, the situation is fluid. But defiance has the upper hand. For example, 22nd of November, Jumhuri Islami, conservative newspaper, writing, Mr. El-Baradei must be reminded that the Iranian people have well understood that any retreat by them from their principal positions in connection with the nuclear issue, as well as any other issue, will make the other side more greedy. If we go back one step, they will move forward two steps. For this reason, the Iranian nation will never retreat from its nuclear positions. That's noble defiance for you. That's the pure voice. And very often, it seems that Ayatollah Khamenei, who has the final word, believes in that. Hence the conflicted nature of their responses to the open hand from the new US administration. And I'm going to finish my little chapter on what's going on in Iran by discussing that briefly. President Obama's message of 4 November, I have made it clear that the United States of America wants to move beyond this past and seek a relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran based upon mutual interests and mutual respect. He went on, Iran must choose. We have heard for 30 years what the Iranian government is against. The question now is what kind of future it is for. And to cut it short, he concludes by saying it is time for the Iranian government to decide whether it wants to focus on the past or whether it will make the choices that will open the door to greater opportunity, prosperity and justice for its people. Very challenging words if you think about the strategy conflict which I've just described. Anyway, President Ahmadinejad gave his response a couple of days ago in a speech in Tabriz. He said, those who claim that they want to have constructive interaction must know that if a clear, fundamental and correct change is observed and the Iranian nation sees that they have truly changed their attitude, have given up their aggressive and arrogant behaviour, are respecting the right and dignity of the Iranian nation, and by returning the right and wealth of the nation they have honestly stretched a hand of friendship towards Iran, Iran will accept it. However, they should know, if they are pursuing deception and mischief in our region again, the response of our nation will be the same definite response which the Iranian nation gave to the predecessors of these gentlemen, meaning Bush. So there you have it. Iran still refuses to accept that its experiment is over, which is basically what Obama was inviting the Iranians to accept. They do not accept that opportunity, prosperity and justice can only be achieved via a deal with the United States. So, regrettably, it still seems that both Iran on the one hand and the United States on the other are setting high barriers to starting serious talks. And that is where we have been for years. Now, Iran and its region. Basically, policy has not changed. It's all about forward defence of territorial integrity and of the revolution by making life tough for Israel and the United States, who they see as still irredeemably against them. They want influence on the decisions being made by the governments in their region, whether on the Arab side of the Persian Gulf or in Central Asia, India, Pakistan or Turkey. As for who is carrying out policy, those difficult subjects of Afghanistan and Iraq were always in the hand of the IRGC, and I'm sure they still are. What about the reaction in the region to those policies? Well, we still hear a lot from the GCC countries about fears of Iranian hegemony and of a US-Iran stitch-up behind their backs. I think that both those fears are overdone. Nor do I think that Iran is showing a predisposition to promote subversion through Shia communities. So much more continuity there than change. Also part of the reaction to Iran is the popular support which Iran enjoys in the Arab world for being seen to stand up to Israel. I think that the election turmoil has taken some of the shine off that, but that is still a political resource which the Iranians have and which the leadership of Arab countries to Iran's west are very nervous about. Policy response to where Iran is in its relations in the region. Well, clearly, military and diplomatic containment has to continue. Clearly, it would be a great advantage in easing our difficulties with Iran if the Middle East peace process could be rescued. And it would help Middle East peace process if we could be pressing on with an Iran process with the objective of improving Iran's behaviour in the region. Secondly, we should clearly be carrying on with the many GCC defence dialogues. that take place between NATO, the GCC, between the US and the GCC, and the lesser players like France and the UK. Clearly, we should be talking up regional defence cooperation, leading ultimately to structures in which Iran and Iraq can be integrated when the time is right. I think to help that, it would be right to declare that normalisation of both Iran and Iraq in the region is the long-term aim. In other words, policy should be built on recognising that an anti-Iran alliance between external powers and particularly GCC countries is simply an impossibility. Iran and Britain. Well, the history shows that it follows a fever chart. It only approached a normal temperature, this relationship, in my view, for a very few months, at the end of 2002 and early 2003. There'd been an interregnum for a year before I arrived because of a dispute over who should be the British ambassador. I was lucky enough to be given the job, and that coincided with the high point of the Jack Straw and Kamel Kharazi period, when there was this serious common interest in mitigating the consequences of an invasion of Iraq, which was going to do great things for Iran by removing their principal enemy to the West. So I think we have to regard that sort of period of semi-normality as an aberration. The history is one under which we have always been on probation, and as far as most of the powers that be in Iran are concerned, we have consistently as a country failed the test of probation. So things have certainly got much harder for my successors, and 2009 is undoubtedly a particularly bad year after four hard ones. The three reasons there, I think it's worth singling out the, to us, a very positive, to the Iranian regime, very, very negative BBC Persian service, underlining for the Iranians our crass insincerity in sending ambassadors to talk about respect, talk about mutual interest, and then sending our journalists and broadcasters to bat against the Islamic Republic, as they would see it, by disseminating information and opinions which the Islamic Republic is trying hard to suppress. Secondly, there's a long-running extradition issue, which is a serious thorn in the side of the relationship. Thirdly, the deprescription of the MKO, and of course now on our side, the totally unjustifiable, wicked imprisonment and trial. Now he's released on bail and sentence of 4 years hanging over him of Hossein Rassam, the member of the embassy staff who was so important to our understanding of what was happening inside the regime and inside Iran by following public affairs and writing it up for us. So the general tenor of Iran's relations with Britain is that we are a serious part of their problem. And as far as the UK is concerned, we are struggling to hang on and to achieve what we can, to project what influence we can, but we need to recognise that in the short term this is not a battle that we can win, so far as the regime is concerned. Nuclear negotiations. The discussions of refuelling the Tehran research reactor. Well, we found the limits, the negotiators found the limits of Iranian capabilities and policies in a dramatic way. Those of us who had been working on this subject recognised the format, which is for an instruction to an Iranian negotiator, which reads something like this: ensure there are no more sanctions, drag things out, get a good deal, and don't give anything away. Now, that's not original to me, that's original to a member of the FCO staff from whom I heard it just the other week. But I think that is roughly what the Iranian instructions are now. I think but for the post-election turmoil, we would have been facing something much more constructive. But the government is nervous, it fears showing weakness, and the factionalism and the personal rivalries are such that with Ahmadinejad associated with the desire to strike a deal, others are jumping on his head simply because they oppose him, rather than looking at the merits for Iran, which are very significant, of the deal originally proposed. I think it's fair to say, too, that what has actually happened has shown that the negotiators in the six put too big a hurdle in front of Iran, given the situation in which it currently was. Maybe they should have been presenting this as a confidence-building measure, rather than as a way of taking Iran's low-enriched uranium away so that the regime wouldn't be tempted to do anything wicked with it, like turn it into nuclear weapons. By making that the dominant, explicit objective, they've managed to stir up every single antibody in the Iranian system. So maybe a historian will say that the negotiators tried to run before they had walked, and they crafted an offer which was not the offer that Iran could not refuse. I'm still optimistic that something could be salvaged, because it is essential for Iran's self-image as a technologically advanced state with a nuclear program that is in the vanguard of everything they want to achieve for their society, that the Tehran research reactor does not grind to a halt. There are hospitals up and down the country that rely on its products. Tot up the number of family members with a relationship to somebody with a disease who is going to find it hard to get treatment because that reactor is not producing its medical isotopes, and you get an idea of the penetration in society of the sense of failure that the regime would have if the reactor ground to a halt. So I still think there is something to negotiate for, and I think the guideline for the negotiators should be, how do we get ourselves in a better situation than we would be in if the negotiations collapsed? Now, any deal may be better than no deal under such a metric. Why? Because a deal, even on one which looks undesirable in relation to the terms that the six have put on the table so far, would help to reverse the cycle of mistrust and suspicion. It would also empower Ahmadinejad against his enemies. Now, if you suggest empowering Ahmadinejad to negotiate, you of course get into the whole subject of whether we should be negotiating with that government at all. You get into the question of legitimacy of the government, of where interests of countries like our own start, and where the interests of the Iranian people in a change of government end. So I'm happy to have that discussion, but I'm not going to give you more of my views now, other than to say that I do think our priority at present must be on trying to make the Middle East safer. And that does mean engaging with the government that Iran has, even though we may have doubts about its essential nature or how the particular administration that they have came to power. Anyway, the current situation, as you know, is that Iran has not fully replied either to the TRR deal suggestions, and it hasn't engaged in the intensified dialogue about its nuclear program, which had been agreed in principle in the Geneva meeting on October the 1st, and it has failed to meet the timings laid down at that meeting, which were the end of October, for such a dialogue to begin. That was the position that the six countries adopted of disappointment at the lack of follow-up to the understandings reached on the 1st of October when the six met in Brussels on the 20th of November. So what now? Well, I've heard the senior representative of one of the six saying that the end-of-year reappraisal does not mean calling a halt to attempts to start a negotiation. The six, this person said, are not going to say a definitive no at the time of the reassessment at the end of the year. If that's the case, I think it would be wise. I think the Tehran Research Reactor outline deal should be kept on the table. I don't believe it's in the interests of either Iran or of the negotiating parties on the other side to break off totally. Well, what about Israel, some will say? Have we got time? I would say yes. I don't think Israel is likely to attack before and unless there is a dangerous new indication of an actual threat from Iran. No change in 2009 over the position in previous years in that respect, in my view. And I think that Israel's friends and associates should continue to encourage this kind of thinking firmly, concentrating on an actual and imminent threat, which after all in international law is what constitutes a reason for preemptive attack in the first place. Secondly, I think we should encourage the six countries to recognize where Iran is in this state of internal chaos and show some self-restraint in exploiting it. So, for example, on the question of human rights in Iran, absolutely right that there should have been a pungent resolution of the General Assembly just a couple of days ago. But absolutely right, too, that we should not declare overt support for particular opposition groups. As another example of self-restraint, I think that a ritual statement by the EU at the end of the year of a twin-track strategy, so we're not getting anywhere in negotiations, so we'd better get on with sanctions, that is futile. It's self-indulgent. Everybody knows that preparations for sanctions are being made, and rubbing it into the faces of the Iranians simply plays into the hands of Ahmadinejad, plays into the hands of those in Iran who say that there is really no change whatsoever in position of their opponents, their enemies, notably the United States. I don't think either way a strong EU statement or no EU statement is going to make any difference to the price of fish, but it's better off keeping our powder dry and not making things harder in Iran than they are already. Well, what about options for the next step? And this is my last section. We're looking at a march to new UN Security Council sanctions and some new unilateral ones, with decisions being taken in several months' time. Meanwhile, trying to schedule talks and waiting for Iran to come around to serious participation. If this was all that we were doing, then I think it would be a council of despair. I'm glad to see that nobody is over-egging the possibility of sanctions making any serious change to Iranian policy. It is being presented as showing we are serious, reinforcing the political message. And if, of course, sanctions do become inevitable, there are five areas that will be looked at, I believe. Oil and gas investment, financial sanctions, sanctions against individuals, tightening and enforcing existing measures, and maybe some sanctions on transport and communications. But the message is that, my message, I beg your pardon, is that what we should be looking at is supplementing the slow march to sanctions with additional diplomatic measures. And I take some encouragement from another remark made by a senior official of a different member of the six, who said, well, if this proposal, the Tehran Research Reactor one, has got nowhere, then we should be looking for further proposals. A couple I could suggest: calling a pause for 2 months on the nuclear talks from the side of the six, reserving the position of the six, of course, and not conceding the Iranian view that nuclear talks are not necessary, and proposing to Iran to start with another subject, for example Afghanistan, or taking ideas out of the Iranian negotiating paper of September. Secondly, and quite rightly, any moves of this nature are being undertaken in secret. I'm talking about the US-Iran bilateral possibilities. There have been letters to Ayatollah Khamenei, we know, but whether it's possible to jumpstart the multilateral negotiations by using back channels, perhaps starting through a third party, I'm sure that's under review and I think it should be encouraged. The objective, of course, is to find that elusive small package of mutual benefit between both parties, which would cut through the suspicions and show both parties that there is something that they can achieve together. It does not have such an initial move, doesn't have to be on the nuclear front. It could be on counterterrorism, on Afghanistan, on maritime interests in the Persian Gulf. The point that I think we need to make is that it has to benefit both sides. It has to be of demonstrable benefit to the people of Iran in some shape. Extremely difficult to find such a thing if the Iranians are determined to see through in private what they're projecting in public, the kinds of quotation that I've given you, their public position, I don't think would be maintained consistently in private, but it's only United States diplomats who can test that, and I may be over optimistic. But to repeat, I think it is in the interests of those who want to see the multilateral negotiations start to empower Ahmadinejad against his opponents to win the battle for permission to engage the United States. After all, the domestic situation in Iran can still get worse for our interests before it gets any better. The third possibility on rethinking diplomacy, put forward by some thinkers in the United States, is to say, well, all this step-by-step issue-specific cooperation has been shown over umpteen years simply not to work, and it is time for a comprehensive bilateral US-Iran negotiation. Put everything on the table at once, define the scope, define the trade-offs, by all means implement in stages, but get the main content of the diplomacy out there right off. The grand bargain. The difficulty with this is that there is no sign that the United States administration has moved sufficiently far in its thinking, or that United States congressional and other dominant political thinking has gone so far as to be able to contemplate that sort of an approach. The incremental approach, even if it's got a pretty poor track record, may be the only one that has any political mileage in the United States and possibly even in Europe. But the grand bargain approach has got many theoretical advantages, and it's plausible, and I hope that at least it might be reviewed to see whether there is a chance of formulating it. Well, sorry, I've lost my place. My conclusion. We do not know what we are dealing with in Iran. We can guess, and I've tried to do that. I leave with you the thought that there are two unfinished campaigns. The internal one to extirpate reformism, and the one on external policy to establish what the strategy should be. Secondly, we need to be clear, as a country that's part of the negotiating group, about what our priorities are now. Are they to do the next thing that occurs on the to-do list, namely sanctions, or are they to still try and tease out an Iranian position which will enable a negotiation to take place? The two may not really be able to be run in parallel. Third, we need to recognise where Iran is and explore alternative diplomatic approaches. And fourth, to assist the recovery of nuclear talks on external policy, we need to cut Ahmadinejad some slack. In short, we need to make haste slowly on sanctions, and we need to continue firmly, coupled with non-interference, on Iran's internal problems. Thank you.